You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Now I want to turn to an exciting quantum experiment that was reported in a paper in Science earlier this year. This is a version of a quantum effect predicted back in the 50s, named after the physicists David Bohm and Yekir Aharonov. Aharonov is also an FQXI member. In fact, I should say that others predicted this effect prior to that too. But Aharonov and Bohm worked out that a particle with an electric charge in a region where there is no electrical magnetic force can somehow still be influenced by them.
This is a really interesting, bizarre effect, which actually has been confirmed experimentally. And so it's something that can only happen if you have a quantum particle. That's kind of why this effect was so interesting when it was proposed initially. And it really has to do with the fact that when you describe a particle with a wave, like in quantum mechanics, you will see some effects that classically you wouldn't see. Like the most famous demonstration uses this, you know, electromagnetic coil, which is a solenoid, ideal solenoid, which has inside it, it has very strong magnetic field, but outside it, it's got zero field. And that's the key, the fact that if you had a classical situation with a particle flying by the solenoid, because there's no field, there would be no net force on the particle, so you wouldn't know that there were this field confined in the solenoid nearby. But if you do it quantum mechanically, and you let this particle into a superposition, one branch of which goes one way around the solenoid, and the other branch goes kind of the other way, and then they together encircle the solenoid, even if the particle wave function doesn't extend inside the solenoid and the solenoid doesn't have any field acting on the particle develops a phase which is detectable when you close the loop. And that's really cool. It's measurable. It's a measurable change to the wave function, even though classically there's no force on the particle.
Physicists had thought for some time that the Aharonov-Bohm effect might also be true for gravitational fields. This has now been confirmed thanks to a new experiment by Mark Kasevich of Stanford University in Palo Alto and colleagues. Kasevich spoke to me earlier about just why he finds the Aharonov-Bohm effect so fascinating, how his team demonstrated it for gravity, and how such experiments might be used to test other aspects of foundational physics. Kasevich began by describing two versions of the long-established Aharonov-Bohm effect for electromagnetic fields, and explained why even now the results are so surprising.
My name is Mark Kasevich, and my affiliation is with Stanford University in the physics department and the applied physics department. It was first noted theoretically in the late 50s by Aharonov and Bohm that there was a peculiar aspect of quantum mechanics when you considered quantum interference in the context of electromagnetic systems. There were two configurations they described, and so I'll quickly summarize them both because they're relevant to our work. The first is a configuration where there's basically a tube of flux created by a solenoid, and then an electron beam in an electron interferometer.
And could you just remind us how an interferometer works?
An interferometer for light, you've probably seen those before, maybe even in a high school course, where you take an input beam of light and you have a partially silvered mirror, and that beam of light splits in two. And one beam goes on the left side and one beam goes on the right side. You have mirrors, you recombine those beams on a second beam splitter. And then depending on the relative phase of the waves on the left and the right arms, the light either bounces off one side of that mirror, that's in the case of, say, constructive interference between the two sets of waves, or the other in the case of destructive interference. And the idea is that you can accrue different so-called phase shifts depending on which arm of the interferometer that light beam has traveled. And so Aharonov and Bohm envisioned this configuration where instead of using beams of light, you know, quantum mechanics says that you can build an interferometer with anything. So let's build one with electrons. The electron goes on the left side and the right side. And you ask the question, well, what is the phase of the two interfering electron beams when they come together at the final beam splitter port? And the amazing thing about this effect is they showed that even though there was no physical force on either of the electron beams, either the beam on the left side or the right side. I say beams, but I should say you should be thinking single electron that's either in the left side or the right side. Even though there's no force, there's still a phase shift. And that phase shift was determined by the amount of flux that was contained in the solenoid. And the amazing thing about this is that there's a magnetic field inside that solenoid, but there's no magnetic field outside the solenoid where the electron is. And that's just like a standard property of solenoid. And yet, there's a signature of that field. no force on the electron, still have a phase shift. And you ask the question, how did the electron experience a phase shift if there's no force on it? Most of our quantum intuition, and for sure our classical intuition, is built on the idea that something happens because there was a force. And so Arnoff and Bohm, you know, proposed this thought experiment. He's like, no, in quantum mechanics, it's a little bit different. In quantum mechanics, the phase of an interference pattern, the mathematically strict way of talking about this, is on the action difference between the two paths. And action is something that is used in classical mechanics to help us, you know, understand forces, but it's sort of a meta concept that also just helps us calculate, in quantum mechanics, it helps us calculate the phase shifts.
That's one version of the Hronov-Bohm effect, where an electron wave function traveling both sides around a solenoid experiences a phase shift, even though it does not pass through a region where it can feel the magnetic force contained within the solenoid. What's the second version of the experiment?
The other equally amazing version of the experiment is the electron is split and made to go in two paths, and one path is steered inside one so-called Faraday cage, which is just a metallic mesh. It's got nothing inside. Picture it just like a metal sphere, if you will. And there's one hole and the other hole, and the electron goes into this hollow metal object. That's what happens on one interferometer arm. And the other interferometer arm, it's a second Faraday cage. Now, what you learn in your intro E&M course is that inside a Faraday cage, there is never an electric field. There's never going to be a force on the electron inside of that Faraday cage. The thought experiment is, when the electron goes inside the Faraday cage, say in the left arm of the interferometer, you pulse on a voltage on the Faraday cage. That changes the potential associated with that Faraday cage. It does nothing to change the electric field inside the Faraday cage, ergo, no force on electron. And yet, just following the basic rules of quantum mechanics, where the phase shift between the interfering electron beams at the output, after the electrons leave the Faraday cages, they recombine, that phase shift is proportional to the voltage pulse times time divided by Planck's constant. Again, a configuration where something happened with the electrons, yet there was no force on the electron wave functions. What's up with that? You know, and so that captured the imagination of the physics community for the past more than 50 years.
So what's the explanation? Is there actually some force leaking into the region where you assume there isn't?
It seemed to me, when I go back to the early literature, and maybe even some of the later literature, like, oh, there's something wrong with that calculation. There must have been a force somewhere. And so there's this cottage industry where you look for the force. And no doubt there are hidden forces. Like, no experiment approaches the perfect ideal. Like in the voltage version I described, that potential has to come on while the electron's inside the Faraday cage. But in quantum mechanics, it's never fully inside. There's always probability of being somewhere. In the magnetic case, there's always a field that leaks outside the solenoid because the solenoid is never infinite in its spatial extent, which is what's required to have zero field. You know, people look for those forces. Nobody was successful in finding the forces. But the idea has stood the test of time. And more recently, there have been some absolutely stunning experimental demonstrations of the truth of this effect. The most convincing experiment, perhaps, is one by Tanimura, where he had a superconducting torus that had some magnetic flux captured, and he sends an electron beam around it in a just an absolutely incredible way. You can directly visualize that phase shift. When you're confronted with data like that, you're like, okay, this effect is real, you know, even though it's exotic. And now there's some technologies and, you know, quantum technologies, for example, where this Arnoff-Bohm physics is just an absolute foundation for entangling qubits and things like that. So that's a brief history of the Arnoff-Bohm effect.
Wow. Yeah, no. So it is quite amazing, but it looks like it's real, even if people are still perplexed.
It's real. Real and perplexing. And there have been some really interesting papers published in just the past decade. For example, an electron, when it's flying through space, has not only an electric field, I mean, we're all familiar with that, but when it's moving, there's also an associated magnetic field. And so when you think about this, you think of that electron not just as being, you know, a point particle that's going through this interference experiment, but also it's the electron and its fields. And the magnetic field of the electron does extend into the solenoid. And when it does extend into the solenoid, it is certainly changing the electromagnetic field energy inside that solenoid. It's doing so in a way that doesn't involve a force back acting on the electron, but there is definitely something physical going on there. In 2021, there was this, a really nice paper where investigators did a quantum treatment of the fields plus the electron plus the solenoid wave functions and basically showed that, you know, when you consider the fields and, you know, their quantum phase evolution, there actually is, if I'm accustomed to the ideas of entanglement, you sort of get a more comfortable intuition. So there's a greater comfort level with the phenomenology. Another interesting paper about a decade ago was a calculation of the force that the electron exerts on the solenoid in the magnetic Erno Bohm experiment. So even though there's no force from the solenoid field on the electron, there is a force from the electron on the solenoid. And the fact that you can have that non-reciprocity is kind of a known feature of electromagnetism. And it turns out that when the electron flies by the solenoid, it experiences a torque. And if you look at the torque in that solenoid and the associated quantum mechanics of that, you can find another explanation for the phase shift that sort of makes you feel a little bit more comfortable. The initial version was it seems like you were getting something for nothing, but it's not quite the case. there are forces, there are energies associated with this. It's just that they're non-local because electricity and magnetism is non-local, is something that is, you know, kind of at the core of this effect.
So you've given us a really good rundown of, you know, the history of this in terms of electricity and magnetism. But your experiments with your colleagues involve gravity. So first of all, you know, why is this something you were interested in looking at?
It was curiosity. Theoretical, you know, ponderings aside, say, well, it'd be kind of cool just to demonstrate that. This is an effect that has captured people's imagination for decades. You say, well, okay, quantum mechanics sort of predicts that I should be able to produce a force-free gravitational configuration for atomic wave packets that still yields a phase shift. You know, quick caveat, you're never going to be able to make a completely force-free gravitational experiment. Even in the most idealized of apparatus, there's always going to be a little bit of residual force. But you say, if you're a believer in quantum mechanics, then there should be configurations where you get a phase shift, which is different from what you would infer from the deflection of wave packets. And that's what we would call, you know, the gravitational Erno Bohm effect. And it's just a curiosity. Could you observe this phase shift? Well, it turns out that there are some rather demanding constraints put on apparatus for observation of this phase shift. For example, you need to have the wave packets separated by a large enough distance that they sort of sense an inhomogeneous gravitational field. You know, in terms of experimental nuts and bolts, it means that you have to be able to separate an atomic wave packet large enough that it can feel the gravitational field of a small object in one of the arms and not feel it so much in the other arm. We sort of understood this for a while, but our apparatus was never in the position to be able to make this demonstration. And finally, in recent years, just by the evolution of the technology associated with the building of atom interferometers, we got to a configuration where we realized we could do this Erno Bohm experiment. And so it's like, let's do it.
So paint us a picture, because most of us have never been in one of these labs.
Yeah, as you would say in Great Britain, I'll tell you about the kit. Yeah. We work in an atomic physics laboratory. And so it's, quote, tabletop, which means that everything fits into one room. This apparatus is larger than most. It's basically a 10-meter tube that's been evacuated to ultra-high vacuum conditions, which means there are just not many gas molecules running around in that tube. And then inside that tube, we have ensembles of atoms that have been laser manipulated and otherwise cooled using modern atomic physics methods to extremely low temperature. And what I mean by that is when these ensembles of atoms, an ensemble has got for us about 100,000 atoms to a million atoms, are cooled, the kinetic energy or velocity spread associated with those ensembles is extremely low. In the standard room, atoms are flying around at kilometers per second. In our apparatus, using these manipulation methods, they're flying around at millimeters per second. So you can think of them essentially as grains of sand. If you just apply these cooling methods and release the atoms, they just fall like a fistful of sand would fall. Of course, they're individual atoms and not grains of sand. And these individual atoms are subject to being able to be manipulated in interferometer configurations. And so what we do is we create one of these ultra cold, we call them ensembles, at the bottom of this 10-meter tube. And then we use radiation pressure to launch the atoms on vertical ballistic trajectories. And you can do the kind of the following neat things. So whereas we might have initially had this set of atoms nearly at rest in the laboratory, we apply laser pulse. Now this set of atoms is moving up vertically at 10 meters per second. And what do they do when they go up vertically at 10 meters a second? Well, they climb under the influence of gravity for about a second, and then they reach the apex of their trajectory, and then they fall back down to the bottom of the apparatus where we can see that by detecting them. How do we see them? Well, atoms scatter light. And so if we flash a laser beam at the atoms of the appropriate wavelength, it will scatter that light extremely vigorously, and we detect the scattered photons on a camera. And so we can make a map of where the atoms were after we launched them up to infer, you know, what their trajectory was and so forth.
Constructing an interferometer then involves more nifty manipulations with laser pulses.
Here comes another set of laser beams. And suffice to say that we can tune these laser atom interactions in such a way that we can make like a beam splitter for the atomic wave functions. Say, just after we launch the atom, we apply a certain sequence of pulses of light. What can happen a second later is the wave function of each atom is described by peaks at two positions in space that are separated by 20 centimeters, 30 centimeters, as much as a half a meter in some of our earlier work. Thinking just roughly about this, you could say that this process of kind of beam splitting puts each of these rubidium atoms in two places at once. You know, it's like there's a probability of detecting the atom a little bit further up the apparatus, and there's a probability of detecting the atom a little bit further down the apparatus. So in summary, tube that's evacuated, some rubidium 87 that's put in there and cooled down to extremely low temperatures such that their momentum spreads are less than a millimeter per second, velocity spreads. We launch them up, we hit them with a bunch of laser pulses that open and close an interferometer, and then we look at the number of atoms at the output ports of the interferometer to infer phase shift.
So we've got the interferometer.
That's the interferometer. Let's talk about how you make the Arnold bone shift. So now we have to come and put some gravity in this problem, all right? We already have the gravitational field of the Earth. That's what's making this go up and down. But as I said before, that's not going to give us the Arnold bone effect. We need to have a smaller object that one of the parts of the wave function will see and the other one won't. And so what we do there is we made a half torus or donut, if you will, of tungsten. Its radius was about 7 centimeters. It was 3 centimeters tall. That's a small object, weighs about a kilogram. And we inserted that in the apparatus near the apex of the trajectories for one of the arms of the interferometer. So one of the arms of the interferometer is about 25 centimeters higher than the other arm. And that one that was 25 centimeters higher manages to come very close to this 7 centimeter mass torus. And it really feels the incredibly strong gravitational field of that 1 kilogram. It's not very strong. It's extremely weak. It exerts a force that corresponds to an acceleration of about a billionth of the acceleration due to gravity. The other part of the atom, the part that's in the interferometer that's 25 centimeters away, doesn't see nearly as strong an interaction. There's one more detail, and that detail is we certainly aren't interested in the phase shift associated with the acceleration due to gravity from the Earth or a bunch of other, you know, kind of technical nuisance phase shifts. So just to further complicate the apparatus, we've run all our experiments in a dual interferometer mode where there's one interferometer that has one of the arms coming close to the tungsten, and then there's another interferometer that's much further away that only sees the uniform gravitational field of the Earth, more or less, you know, some of the other dirt effects. And we use that second interferometer to characterize these effects and to null them out so that at the end of the day, what we measure is just the gravitational interaction of the upper interferometer with the tungsten proof mass. That's the apparatus.
So I can understand how if you run these two experiments, you can kind of work out the effect of the gravitational field due to the Earth and cancel that out so that that's not sort of messing up your results. But what about effects of like, I don't know, somebody walking past the experiment in the lab next door? Does that not have an effect on the experiment?
Yes and no. So there are a couple of ways that a person walking next door can influence the interference fringes in our experiment. One is as they walk, their footfall can make the lab vibrate and they can make our lasers shake, you know, like boom, boom, boom. Everything starts to shake at a little level. That actually introduces phase shifts, but it does so in a way that is completely common to both of the interferometers. canceling out vibration noise such as that is crucial. If you can't do that, you would never be able to see the much smaller phase shifts that we're observing associated with the tungsten mass. The other effect is the gravitational effect. A person gravitates, and you know, if that person gets too close to the apparatus, you'll certainly see the gravitational field of that person influencing the interferometer phase shift. Now, it turns out that it works out to be about 10 to the minus 9 G for a person pulling on another person, you know, about a meter away is 10 to the minus 9 G. And if that person is kept a reasonable distance away from the apparatus, that gravitational field is not going to be a problem. And it's not going to be a problem for two reasons. One, it's going to be weak enough. And two, it's not going to have enough curvature. There's one other thing we do to reject spurious gravitational forces. And that is we make sets of measurements where we compare the phase shift we observe with the tungsten in close to the atoms. And then we pull the tungsten out of the apparatus and we measure that differential phase shift again. And we subtract those two phase shifts. So we basically can isolate the phase shift due to the tungsten.
You've sort of explained how everything works. Now tell me, when you flick the on switch and you wait for, you know, your experiment to run, and then you come in and you read off the results, how excited were you to find out that it had worked?
We were very excited. You know, if you're in the fundamental physics mindset as experimentalists, one of the exciting things, you have a technology side to physics where you're trying to develop new technology, but you also have that discovery side. And you're trying to put yourself in a position where you might possibly discover something. And in atomic physics, it's hard to be in that position. There's not a lot of uncertainty left out there. But in this particular case, because so little is known about how gravity and quantum mechanics work together, there was the possibility that that effect would not have been observed.
Let me ask you then, what now? What else could people go on and measure, perhaps, or use this sort of effect for?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of directions. One is what's been just motivating for us in the past months is you talk to people and you say, well, you know, what does this mean about quantum gravity, for example? Is there something that we can say about quantum gravity which is different from what they say in the high energy physics black hole community, but nonetheless important? There's an important question out there, and that question is, can gravitational fields exist in superposition? Classical gravitational fields, can they be in superposition? Does our experiment have anything to say about that? That's one direction we're working right now. It's not going to have any new experiment required to sort that out. It's just going to be, you know, thinking about the implications of what it means to measure that shift, just like in the Arnold Bohm experiment. 50 years after the initial proposal, there's still paper being published about what it means. I think there's an aspect to the work we did that is in a similar thing. There's also just a technological, I say, applications direction. The methods we developed kind of push the frontier for precision inertial measurements with atom interferometry. And there are some really interesting applications. Like if I have a sensor that can very precisely measure inertial forces, what can I do with it? Well, one thing people do or one can do is to characterize anomalies in the Earth's gravitational field. And one promising way to do that is to put such an apparatus in satellite orbit. You're not doing an Arnold Bohm experiment. You're measuring the gravitational gradient of the Earth's field. And for a low enough satellite orbit, what you end up seeing are small changes in the Earth's gravitational field associated with mass and inhomogeneity on the surface. For example, the water table changes the amount of gravity that you would observe with a very sensitive instrument. If the Greenland ice sheet is melting, water is moving. That's actually something that can be characterized on a global scale with precision gravimetric measurements. And so we're excited to see if you know, kind of this atom interference method will have impact in such an application space.
There's one more possible application involving determining the precise value of Newton's gravitational constant big G, which appears when we try to calculate the strength of the gravitational force between two masses a certain distance apart.
You know, once you put a wave packet in proximity to a piece of tungsten, and you say, well, what was the phase shift? You have to haul out this constant, capital G, Newton's constant, which is famously known somewhat imperfectly. It's only measured to like 10 parts per million. And even then, the people who are trying to measure that constant disagree on their observed value by many standard deviations. You know, is there something wrong with our understanding of gravitation? You know, maybe the gravitational constant isn't constant, or is there something wrong with those experiments? It would be nice to make another determination of Newton's constant with a completely independent method. And so the experiment there would be to replace our rather sloppy tungsten toroid with something that's precision machined and well-characterized and measure the phase shift from that. So that's a direction that we're excited to pursue and probably will do so in the coming years.
So that was Mark Kasevich talking to Zia. We'll put a link to his science paper on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast.